My name is Murray Levin, and I want to welcome you to another beautiful day in Philadelphia, and I want to welcome you to Pepper Hamilton, and I have a few very brief announcements, and then I have the honor of introducing a very distinguished and interesting guest. In the way of announcements, just as has become de rigueur in just about every gathering, I'm going to ask people to turn off their cell phones. Nobody wants to do that. I wanted to notify you that we will take questions at the conclusion, and that session will be run by Ronnie Gordon Stillman, who is sitting at the other end of the conference table. And I wanted also tell you how pleased I am to kind of acknowledge the ongoing partnership between the Middle East Foundation, the Middle East Forum, and Pepper Hamilton. And over the years, we have very much enjoyed the opportunity of hosting some of the many, many fascinating guests and programs which go on year in and year out. So I just wanted, on behalf of my colleagues and partners here, to tell you that. Our speaker today is really special. I think you know that Azar Nafisi is originally from Iran, and she is the author of a very intriguing book and a very successful book, which is entitled Reading Lolita in Tehran. And I'm informed from a very reliable source that Reading Lolita in Tehran is up and around the 100 mark on the computer, I'm blanking on the name, Amazon rating.
You quit.
I don't make a lot of predictions, but I'm willing to predict that it's going to get a lot higher, and you watch for it in the bestseller list on the New York Times. Now, the book, as you probably know, and you may have read a review about it, concerns our guest's life in Tehran and a kind of reading group that she got together with seven young women in town. They would meet in her home, I think, and they did what was incredibly subversive, given their cultural and societal situation, which was to read The Turn of the Screw or read Daisy Miller or read Lolita and talk about it and think about it in a cultural and political way. And in addition, her book gives some very interesting inside views of what it was like during the Iran-Iraq War from the Iranian side, and I think a portrait of what it's like to be a woman in revolutionary Iran today. But you'll have to buy it and read it yourself. It's available after you close the program, and if you're good, you might get a special inscription on it. Without further ado, I just want to, with great pleasure, introduce Azar Nafisi, and I want you to know that she is a visiting professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, and she's also the director of a very interesting dialogue program.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for a very, very generous introduction. It's a great privilege and pleasure for me to be speaking here. I remember that I think it was the first year when I returned to the U.S. It was in 1997 or 1998, and one of the first places I spoke at was at the Middle East Forum, and I have such amazing memories from that. And then I had the privilege of, you remember, at Washington Institute when, at the time in 1999, when the student uprising in Iran took place, which was suppressed very harshly, and I remember that Daniel Pipes and I gave a talk trying to convince people, futile manner, to support that movement and to support democracy in Iran, and I'm very much pleased and grateful that I'm here today. One of the best things about books is that it makes you, they give you the opportunity to meet people whom you always have wanted to meet and have no other way of meeting except through the book. So this is what I'm grateful to this book and every other book that I have read and I have appreciated in my life. Now, I know that because Iran is so much in the news nowadays, a lot of people would want me to also talk about what the situation is in Iran. And I thought that it would be interesting perhaps to be saying how does reading Lolita in Tehran clarify issues about, for example, Iran's weapons of mass destruction? What is the relationship between these two? And how is it that at least this is what I would claim, and I'm not claiming from a political point of view. I'm not a political person. I have no ambitions politically. In fact, I like to take the pose of being very anti-political. But the point about it is that when you're talking about what we call Islamist fundamentalism, and I'm a little worried, I don't have any scholarly knowledge the way Professor Pipes does. When we talk about this issue today, I think that at the center of it is the issue of ideology. That what is happening in terms of Islamic fundamentalism, there are two aspects to it. One is that I think Islam is in genuine crisis, and it has been in crisis for a long time. And in order for the Muslim world to be able to come out of this crisis, it needs to attain a critical and a self-critical look at itself and not blame the world, although it should look at the world critically as well. So that is one issue, which I think if you want to see about how this issue is being resolved, you have to again look at Iran, because Iran is a country where you had the first, for the first time in the history of 20th century, you had a theocracy imposed upon a modern state, although that state had its basic problems, and I won't go into that. So what is happening in Iran today and the way this issue is being resolved today, Iran becomes the first country in the so-called Muslim world to which I object. I don't think we should lump all these countries together as Muslim. This was again a gift of Iran. It was after 1979 when we stopped calling them Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Indonesia, and stopped calling them the Muslim world. They are very different, both in terms of history, culture, and tradition, and they cannot be summarized into that term. But at any rate, the point with Iran is that having gone through that revolution and having failed, and that revolution has failed despite what many people, including the Iran mission and its proponents in various universities across this country, try to tell you, because of its failure, many of the people who were proponents of the revolution had to look at themselves critically and had to question where they went wrong. And so it is no accident that today you have those who were hostage takers at some point to be now in jail and to be not quoting Ayatollah Khomeini or even Quran, but to be quoting Hannah Arendt and Karl Popper or referring to issues related to secularism and democracy, quoting de Tocqueville and quoting Kant and Spinoza and people like that. So Iran again is central in this ideological transformation that will take place in the Muslim world. Now, having said that, why again reading Lolita in Tehran? I think that you should realize that this being an ideological war, this is not just a religious, issue. It is taking religion as an ideology, the same way that the communists took Marxism as an ideology. Even an ignorant lay person like me knows that Muhammad did not know what the term imperialism and neocolonialism and the difference between haves and have-nots were, and that all these issues upon which the Islamic Republic was built was taken directly and indirectly from actually the Soviet Union and the leftists both actually in the matter of hostage taking and in the matter of formulating these issues, they're very much involved. And I will try, what I want to do is to go in through different chapters of this book, bring out some of these issues, because I think that policies cannot be created without having a context. It can't be tactical, you have to have a strategy. And in order to have a strategy, you have to understand the situation. You genuinely have to understand the culture and not the way our cultural pundits tell us we have to understand the culture. This regime in Iran and the fundamentalists around the world have targeted three things in relationship to the Western world. And they have targeted these three things in their homeland before they targeted them in the Western world. That is the issue of the rights of women, cultural rights, and the rights of minorities, all three of which are related to human rights. And every time someone or a group has tried in these countries to fight for these rights or to fight for democracy, that person or group has been linked to the Great Satan, a title that U.S. had the privilege of having until very recently, to the Great Satan. The way I look to you today would be considered as westernized, and at one point at the beginning of the revolution, wearing a tie meant you that you were an imperialist sympathizer. So that is why reading Lolita in Tehran becomes central to an understanding of why weapons of mass destruction are related to the way this regime is behaving towards its own people. For people like me, fighting against this regime is not a political fight. It's an existential fight. If as a woman, as a writer, as a person believing in a set of values, you are being negated and denied, then you fight for your survival. You don't fight just to change a regime, and I think it is wrong to use regime change, the term regime change, in terms of these countries. You have to change a system which is a totalitarian system, which is much more difficult than changing regimes. So the targets of these regimes, especially Iranian regime that has formulated this so nicely, has been these three. And these are the issues that I talk about in my own book. And that is why today, not the political elite in that country, but people who are either activists in these realms that I talk about, are at the forefront of the struggle for change in Iran. And on July 9th, there has been a call for a referendum on the nature of both the constitution of Iran and the country. So you notice that a different kind of velvet revolution could happen in Iran, which could change the face of our policies in relationship to the present crisis. Having said that, you mentioned how this book begins, and what I would like to do is go over each chapter very briefly, and although I have the clock in front of me, I'm very bad at policing myself. Somebody else should police me, and in this case, you would please do that. I love captive audiences, but I know that one should be checked. This book is about the title, actually. It's about reading. And although it is a celebration of writing and of imagination as a whole, more than that, it is a celebration of the act of reading. And I want to quote Nabokov, one of my favorite writers, and my first book was on Nabokov, actually. He says that readers are born free, and they ought to remain free. Now, I wanted the American people to understand not just the plight of writers in my country, because writers do get some publicity and coverage, but the plight of millions of readers and their right for their imagination and for their reality to be free so that they can fulfill and achieve and realize their fullest potentials. And what is at stake here in these countries is the plight of the readers. So this was the first aspect of it. The second aspect, of course, is Lolita. And I will mention why Lolita, specifically because it is not a political novel, specifically because it remains true to a republic of imagination. It becomes much more politically subversive than those books that claim to be political, because democracy is all about fields and areas of human endeavor that are both interconnected to one another, but at the same time independent. And if imagination and thought becomes captive to politics, it loses its subversiveness. And that is what is happening, not just in Iran, but in your own universities, in this country. And this is an issue that some of us were talking about before the meeting started. So I wanted to let you know that by knowing about Iran, you are not only helping people in Iran who are fighting for these issues, but you're helping yourself. This is our gift to you, that we reassert those values that sometimes people take for granted, and remind you that you cannot be smug about them. You know, that you know, imagination and thought are like your hands and eyes. As long as you have them, you don't notice them. But when you live in a country like mine, when your hands are chopped off, then you remember how you cannot function without them. And I think Americans should always keep that in the back of their minds. There's a wonderful book by Diane Ravitch called The Police, The Thought Police, or Police Language, or Language Police. Or we just rename and reinterpret books the way we want to. She talks about the educational system here and the textbooks in this country, and how the same mentality that rules the Islamic Republic in fact rules that board of censorship in our education. And I won't go into that, but during the question and answer period I would really like to address the issue that Diane Ravitch brings up. The first chapter of my book is about Lolita, and it's about these girls that I gathered. I resigned, I was expelled from University of Tehran in 1979 when I returned to Iran because I refused to wear the veil. It took them almost 2 years before they could make the veil mandatory. If it was our culture, we would not have needed a morality police, two armed men and women searching the streets of Tehran for weapons of mass destruction, which was basically lipstick and strands of your hair showing up. Now, so nobody puts a gun to your head to go to your church or to your synagogue, and nobody puts a gun to your head to read Mark Twain. Once people put a gun to your head to do any of these, then you know it's not your culture. So don't believe these people who tell you that it's their culture to change the age of marriage, which was changed in Iran from 18 to 9. It is not our culture. It was not our culture to have women and men stoned to death for adultery. It is not our culture to put on this mandatory veil, because both religion and individual lifestyle should be free. The lives of Muslims were taken away from them when they were forced to wear the veil, not as a religious token, but as a token which was now political. A Muslim woman has the right to appear like I do, or appear like the way state tells them to do. That is her choice. So the issue is not the veil, but choice. Now, understanding this then, you understand why I'm so close to Lolita. Because Lolita, what is it all about? In the very first page, Nabokov says that did Lolita have a precedence? Yes, Annabelle Lee, a girl he falls in love with when he's 13 and she's 11, and she dies and their love is never consummated. And ever since then, Humbert stops living. He lives in the past. He lives with this obsession of Annabelle Lee, and he imposes that obsession upon Lolita's life, and he justifies it by saying that she wasn't just a vulgar little vixen. She was infatuated with Humbert because he looked like a movie star, and he says that she seduced him. And Humbert, cleverly, is very sophisticated. He's the kind of person we might invite to our lectures. He knows about Aeschylus. He can bring all sorts of references for his crime, while Lolita is just a gum-chewing little girl, you know. Now, this is the whole point of the story, and I think that is what Nabokov should be lauded. We don't condemn totalitarianism just because of their concentration camps and torture chambers and executions. We condemn them for confiscating the lives of millions of ordinary people who just want to live. That Lolita had the right to be whatever she wanted to be. And that right was taken away from her once Humbert enters her life and confiscates that right. the same way with our reality. When Ayatollah Khomeini imposed his lifestyle coming from the past, in the name of my past, rewriting my history, telling me how I should dress, he turned me into a figment of his imagination. And thereby, both of them basically committed the same crime. Both of them committed the crime of taking away another person's individuality, and that is what totalitarian states are scared of. Individuality. In China, they tell you to wear Mao jackets and no makeup. In Iran, they tell you to wear the veil. It is not religion, but uniformity. So this was the first chapter, and I wanted to show you that we were not victims, that we are not going to celebrate our victimhood, as is very much fashionable here. Ways through which people find to not become victims, not dance with their jailers, which is what Nabokov did. And writing and imagination as the concentration camps that people like Primo Levi and so many other of my favorite writers have shown us, life at its extreme, when all choices are taken away from you, you still have your imagination and your thought in order to remind yourself of the highest achievements of human individuality and integrity, which goes back to works of imagination. Very fast, and I'll go very fast. The second chapter is on Great Gatsby. And that was when I naively, in 1979, when I taught at the University of Tehran, I found it ironic when I started writing that I was teaching Great Gatsby upstairs while downstairs in the yard of the university, people were shouting down with U.S. imperialism, and two streets above there, they were taking Americans as hostage. And many of my Islamic students and Marxist students didn't like Gatsby. And one of them, who was the head of one of a later Islamist association, told me, this guy is decadent. This is the values for which we threw U.S. out. Why should we study Gatsby? And I felt that he was not reading Gatsby as Gatsby, but he was reading it as a prosecutor. So I decided to have a trial in my class where we put Great Gatsby on trial. I assigned him to be the prosecutor, and they told me I should be the defense because I chose the book, not they. So I had the honor, the highest honor perhaps in my life, of becoming the Great Gatsby. And a wonderful girl whom I never saw after that year in 1980, she became the defense. And I won't go into that chapter, but I want to mention one thing. The result that at least most of us reached was that a great work of art always transcends its time, its place, and the flaws of its author. Fitzgerald in real life might have loved the wealthy to the point of obsession, and he might have destroyed his personal life for that love. But in his book, whom does he condemn? Tom and Daisy Buchanan, who are the wealthiest, of course, in the class, and being just wealthy is not a crime on its own, but what is a crime is that they're careless, that they clear messes which other people have to clean up after them. And this is why novel is so important, and it's one of the highest achievements of Western civilization. And I agree with Richard Rorty that if this civilization was destroyed and we wanted to explain to another people what is the high point of, you know, the Western civilization, he said he would choose the novel form as the most democratic, the most critically self-reflective form that exists in the world today in terms of our imagination, which also creates our sensibilities. So this is the Great Gatsby. It ends with my expulsion from the University of Tehran for refusing to wear the veil and my feeling of victimhood that I was now irrelevant. The third chapter is James. James was one of the most controversial of all writers in my classes. People would shout and quarrel over James. They hated ambiguity, which is what he had. And they hated Daisy Miller, and they definitely wanted her dead. And they couldn't understand why she should become a heroine. And this was during the Iran-Iraq War, the 8 years of Iran-Iraq War, when I read James and Dorothy Sayers and Raymond Chandler all side by side and created a curriculum for my later class. I just want to mention very briefly that I dedicate Washington Square to a very tiny little student of mine whose name was Razieh, and she loved Washington Square, and she identified with Kathleen. And many years later, another student came to see me, and she told me that she and Razieh had been in the same jail together, and they talked about Gatsby. She told her about Gatsby. Razia told her about James. And Razia was executed later on. And it was just so strange for me where these books went to. You know, it wasn't just the academia where they went to. And the last hours, or I like to think that she thought of Catherine as she went to her death. And the last part is Austen. And I would like to end it with Austen. And just, I was going to read a part from Lolita, but I won't. But I would like to end it with Austen and read the paragraphs from that. Austen is all about choice. And for us, especially as women living in Iran, we understood it. Austen is one of the most revolutionary writers I have come across. Austen is not merely about marriage. Marriage is two lines at the end of every single novel she writes. At the center of the English novel, beginning with Clarissa and Tom Jones and now Austen and on until well into 19th and 20th century, at the center of the novel, the most subversive element is always a woman. And the issue is the woman saying no to the power and authority of her family, of her society, and welcoming a life of bleak poverty, but saying, I marry the man I want to. I make my choice about whom I marry. And that issue of choice will never die. It will always be with us in different forms. I now in my classes teach Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God alongside of Austen about the issue of choice. And she's so political, democratic. She gives every single character the right to speak. Even her villains have a voice of their own. And they're not eliminated, they're not banished, they live side by side with the other voices. This is the great achievement of democracy. Not that you don't have villains among you. Both fundamentalism and democracy are universal. You have your brand of terrorists and fundamentalists, and we have our brand of Democrats. What makes a difference is that over here, your fundamentalists and terrorists do get free process of law. I nowadays watch Law and Order a lot, actually. I'm sorry, I shouldn't bring that up, but I do love intent, not criminal intent, I hate that one. But, and especially that guy, I think he should be shipped to the Islamic Republic. But in criminal intent, it's horrible. But at any rate, this is, I mean, they get the due process of law, and your fundamentalists have other voices that would reject them and enter into a dialogue with them. And I think that is the most important thing in a democracy. So I wanted to, some might have read this book, and they know that in this book I have a character whom I call my magician. And this is near the end of the book, when I went to say goodbye to him, when I decided to come back to U.S. And I wanted to end this, I'm sorry, monologue with these few paragraphs. I have a recurring fantasy that one more article has been added to the Bill of Rights, the right to free access to imagination. I have come to believe that genuine democracy cannot exist without the freedom to imagine and the right to use imaginative works without any restrictions. To have a whole life, one must have the possibility of publicly shaping and expressing private worlds, dreams, thoughts, and desires, of constantly having access to a dialogue between the public and private worlds. How else do we know that we have existed, felt, desired, hated, feared? We speak of facts, yet facts exist only partially to us if they're not repeated and recreated through emotions, thoughts, and feelings. To me, it seemed as if we had not really existed, or only half existed, because we could not imaginatively realize ourselves and communicate to the world, because we had used the works of imagination to serve as handmaidens to some political ploy. That day when I left my magician's house, I sat on the top steps of the apartment house and wrote these words in my notebook. I dated the entry June 23rd, 1997, and wrote beside the date for my new book. That day when I left my magician's house, the sun was fading and the air was mild, the trees a verdant green, and I had many reasons to feel sad. Every object and every face had lost its tangibleness and appeared like a cherished memory. My parents, friends, students, this street, those trees, they were drawing light from the mountains in the mirror. But I was also vaguely elated. And to paraphrase Muriel Spark's heroine in her wonderful novel, Loitering with Intent, I went about my way rejoicing, thinking how wonderful it is to be a woman and a writer at the end of the 20th century. Thank you for your patience. I also have the pictures of my girls. I call them girls. The last day I was in Iran, I talk about it in my first chapter, we took a picture of us, the way we looked and the way we were forced to look. And the one who observed the veil, I want you to see her in this photograph and find her in this other one and see how different she would look even when she wears the veil.
Ronnie, we're going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Laurie. Also, that was wonderful. I think you really said beautifully the liberating nature of literature as we were speaking earlier. And if I can exercise the prerogative as a Q&A monitor, I would just like to pick up, you had mentioned Diane Ravitch's Language Police, and I think maybe if you wouldn't mind addressing that, I'll give you time to finish.
Thank you so much.
The totalitarian nature of so many of our departments, humanities departments in the university, politically correct agendas, the terrible disservices being done to students with the abandonment of the canon. Victimology, I mean, all these things. And how we see, through Middle East Studies departments.
Yeah.
But it's just as Victor Davis Hanson wrote about, the classics departments are gone also this way, bonfire of humanities. So if you can address that, and also your sites right now, you were mentioning life teaching there. and you have a couple of Johns Hopkins. There's a whole contingent of
that's frightening. I bring you an example to show you how, and that is why I think the question of these countries and fundamentalism really should go beyond what should our next policy be towards Iran. It should go to what is happening in our own country as well, which is more fundamental, I think. But Diane Ravitch, I just give you an example from Iran, an example from her book to show you how similar they are. For example, they in Iran, they censored Desdemona from Sir Laurence Olivier's Othello. And they also, most of the scenes with Desdemona, and they also censored the last part where Othello commits suicide because they said suicide is not good for the morale of the country. Now, they also put scarves on children's books. They put scarves on the hens so that the hen would be properly dressed in the children's stories. They took out olive oil from most of the Popeye cartoon scenes because that relationship was illicit. Now, if you read just the first part, the first pages of Diane Ravitch, you will find many similar stories. For example, the Aesop's fable of the fox and the crow, where the fox flatters the crow who drops the food and he picks it up. They objected to it because it was insulting to women, because it showed the crow as a woman being vain, and the fox as very foxy and intelligent, so it showed the men in a much better light than the women. And they had to eliminate the sexes of the animals in order to show it. There was a story about a heroic blind guy who goes to the top of a very difficult mountain. They said that this story cannot exist because the blind, it is discriminatory against the blind. Saying blindness is bad, I guess, and those children who don't live in the mountainous regions would get a bad idea about mountains because it was difficult to climb mountains. Now, you can go through this. Of course, you know that Huckleberry Finn has been, seriously eliminated and criticized by the left, and then we have the right criticizing Harry Potter. So between the two, I don't know how much you have left. And if you don't let, you see, literature is the only place. That is why we need it as opposed to politics. In politics, you need certain frameworks within which, you have to work within frameworks. And it's all about compromise. Literature is all about irreverence. It is not mainly only about the sacred, but it's also about the profane. And it allows you to play with the reality, which is not very playful a lot of times. You take that away from children, not just from adults. And what have you got left? And how will this country claim to be carrying on the heritage of from de Tocqueville to Hawthorne to Emerson to Thoreau? I mean, how could this country remain what it still is? Allowing people like me to come here and feel at home the moment we step off the plane, if you don't agree the difference that genuinely exists through the picture.
Your point interests me, and the language police offends me grievously too. But what I'm wondering about is whether or not you would agree that there is a, if we're talking about kids, let's say, that there's at some point we ought to draw a line, because I remember reading about a book that some right-wing nut wrote about the revolution that would come when there would be black people and Jews hanging from the lampposts and so on, and it seemed just particularly hideous. And, I'm offended by censorship, but I wonder, are there some works, certain things
on the, you're right. There's so many different ways of, for education, when you, and of course at different stages people will be reading different books. I mean, there are certain kids that even Gatsby, a kindergarten or an elementary school person would not be reading it. And you're right about that. For the education system, I think we should really train people to think. And classics and the canon helped with that. That is what I was objecting to, that the standards for choosing books at our schools nowadays is not necessarily the high quality of fiction, but the politically correct aspects of it. And that is why Huckleberry Finn can be censored out. Within larger society, when somebody like that writes, you have so many people who respond to him and are able to respond to him, but a kid won't be able to do that. A kid still needs guidance. So I think we need guided reading, definitely. We can't allow everything in our schools. I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that. But Aesop's Fables, that is what bothers me.
Let's take questions.
Yes. I was amazed when I visited you on how lionized they were with the literary figures and heroes of their country. I mean, we named bridges after our poets. They have these magnificent monuments and gardens, and people are constantly going there. And one of the things that I really looked at in terms of what we're doing as a country in terms of encouraging this non-conformity, I saw it happening in Iran. Young girls like the ones that you were teaching, they show their ways to be non-conformist, whether it was having a loose veil, wearing more makeup, but I even saw more things, like shaking hands with a Westerner. I saw young men and women holding hands. I saw protests like that. Given the fact that that's happening in Iran, and we know how young that population is, how do we really constructively engage that so that type of our message is out there? We know the internet is there. We know these young people want to have access to cable TV, and we know, in fact, it's there. Given that overlay is out there, what do we, as Western supporters of that movement, need to do to promote that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I also mentioned, especially at the end of my book, how what the regime did, which turned against it by turning women into political tokens, then people used it, and this is millions of people. It's not just the political elite. Of course, the political elite were saying this is bourgeois individualism, what you guys are doing. They turned the way they dressed into a political statement. And so the young girls would either leave their hair out here or in the back. They would be taken to jail, flogged. 76 lashes is the usual thing. Come out into the streets, wear nail polish, I started wearing lipstick when I went back to Iran. I was really mad. So what you're saying is true. One thing you Westerners should do, they should start dispelling this myth that so many journalists and others are bringing here, that these people want an Islamic form of democracy. You can't be a little Islamic, as a student of mine said. A little Marxist or a little pregnant. What is Islamic democracy? I want somebody to explain to me. As opposed to Christian democracy, Judaic democracy, I don't know. And the second thing is broadcasting. Broadcasting through satellite television becomes very important as an education in democracy. The third thing is the experience of Eastern Europe. Iran is very close, not like Saudi Arabia, to Eastern Europe in that manner.
Obviously, people are affected by this conflict of civilization.
Yes.
How are they affected by Western culture?
Well, you see, sir, that is another thing. Like, this confrontation of civilizations, which was something so much at the service of the fundamentalists, it turned something that was genuinely universal, like culture, and turned it into something completely segregated and irreconcilable. You have the word algebra. I mean, in your culture, that comes from Arabs, and you never think about it. And you remember that Al-Farabi, the great Iranian philosopher, translated Plato and Aristotle from Greece into Arabic, and then it was reintroduced to Europe through Spain. Goethe was in love with Hafez, and Fitzgerald translated Khayyam. And then we are now reading your Jane Austens and your Karl Popper's and your Kant's and Spinoza's, and none of us feel as if there are barriers to thought. What these people did, because these works of culture, these emissaries from the Western world, are so dangerous to them in their own land, they branded it as, you know, conflict and not a means of communication. And I think we should go beyond governments and continue with the subversive exchange of culture between the two.
Well, if children are indoctrinated from the time they are born, yeah, into that culture,
they don't listen, sir. Iran is the best example. Of course, a country like Saudi Arabia, where women still don't even drive, is different from Iran, where for the past 150 years women have been active in many walks of life. What happens with indoctrination, in Iran at least, where I have first-hand experience, is that people become reactive against it. My children, when we were living in Iran, were much more uncritical of Western culture than I had ever been in my youth. I lived in the year, I still am much more critical of Western culture than my students in Iran are. I mentioned in the last part of my book, one thing that I worried about my students was that they were too uncritical. And I would teach them Saul Bellow, Dean's December, Mordor of Heartbreak, Bella Rosa Connection, to show them about the sufferings of freedom, that they have to understand that. So people react against that indoctrination a lot of times. At least I know about Iran. I know that it's different in other countries. You know, they're not all the same.
Do you have a question? Earlier you mentioned this July 9th referendum.
Yeah.
Could you explain that a little bit more? And could you also explain a little bit about satellite TV and how accessible that is, and whether that's technologically feasible for American ideas to be projected into Iran?
Western videos and satellites are forbidden, are banned. You have at least up to 1 year in jail plus monetary fines. And almost everyone has a satellite dish. Sometimes they don't understand the language, but they still have it. On the borders, near, closer to the Arabic countries, they get the satellite without the dish from, you know, the Arab countries. And on the border to Soviet Union, to Russia, they also do the same, or Azerbaijan. And what worries the government is not people like me watching the satellite. The traditional families, the more religious and poorer areas of Iran, in the cities, one person would buy a satellite dish, and then they would sell tickets to people to go and watch it. And this was, of course, a mixed blessing, but that is what democracy is all about, because in 1996, David Hasselhoff claimed that Baywatch was the most popular show in Iran. I had never seen a soap opera while I lived in U.S., and I lived here for the most of my adult years. The first time I saw Santa Barbara and the Bold and the Beautiful, it was in Tehran. Alongside of that, BBC World is very popular. CNN is very popular. And so these are very good means of, creating dialogue and discourse. The problem is that it's not that people should not watch Baywatch, because people watch Baywatch anyway, but that people should have the permission and the authority to talk about Baywatch, and to be able to talk critically about Baywatch, and to have the choice of watching Masterpiece Theater side by side with Baywatch, you know. So I think that U.S. can do a lot in bringing this dialogue, and in telling people that American culture is not just Britney Spears, nor is it just classic jazz. It's a mixture, and you have to understand both sides. You know, that, I think that's a good counter attack against fundamentalism.
The July 9th referendum. What is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. In 1999, the students around July 9th went on a massive demonstration. I mean, it was a small, peaceful, lawful protest which was attacked by the vigilantes, and it turned into massive demonstration which was put down brutally by the government, and many of the leaders were jailed, some were killed, some were abducted. And that July 9th, 1999 or 98, I always mix the dates, became a stepping stone for the movement, the student movement that developed. Those students, at the time they went on strike, many of them called themselves Islamic Students Associations. Now they have changed their name to Democratic Students Associations, and they're asking for secular state. And so they're asking for a commemoration of July 9th, for the people to come into the streets and express solidarity.
Is there any reading of Ayn Rand? I mean, although her writing is so heavy with thesis, it really exalts, yeah, creativity, imagination, self-expression.
You know, one thing about these writers is that somebody who's familiar with them has to introduce them, and then they become vogue. And Rand, actually, I think that right before I left, they had translated Atlas Shrugged, most probably, and Fountain. I'm glad you asked that, because I have to find out about what happened. I'm sure that she would be very popular, because also she has such a storyline which attracts people a great deal.
Well, you didn't answer with this question, but an important thing which someone interested me years ago. I used to do theater, and I used to have a mad theater in Philadelphia. And at that time, I was hosting people which came from Eastern Country, Czechoslovakia, and foreign directors. And if I have in these countries where they were very suppressed in the writing description, they had enormous amount of mind theatres. And I said, why? And they said, because mind is only a muscle, the interpretation is in the mind of the person. So they were able to do poetical messages, translate books, etc., just because of mind, because you cannot deny the word was there, because it was only seen by the people. So it was an interesting thing, which is the beginning of the Greek theatre, when they used to mind the play to give the political point of view of the play. And the question is,
nothing like this ever happened in Iran.
The Mayans, well, actually, they did use them. They also started having street theater, street performances, which became very, and they used very, very creative ways of doing things, like Jean Genet's, you know, Jean Genet is such a, I mean, even in the West, he has got trouble. His play, these young people put it, and then, for example, you couldn't have a glass of wine, but what they did, they drew with chalk the picture of a glass of wine on the floor, or the picture of an hand. I mean, you know, so they use very creative ways of expressing themselves. That is why we're so close to Eastern Europe in so many ways, you know. And they're very popular in Europe. Very popular.
Yes. And you had a reference earlier in your talk to the Velvet Revolution in Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia. What do you, that had, to a certain degree, the military of Iran aligned themselves with this as well. What do you envision for Iran 3 years from now, and what is the role and the attitude of the military people within Iran?
I hate to predict anything, not just because I'll be found out, but because I'm not in a position to. But I think that Iran, I mean, this government, you really don't have a state in Iran right now. You have different power groups that try to negate one another, but they all agree on the fact that you have to keep the power structure. And what it has done, it has created great demoralization within the ranks, especially rank and file in military and in the militias, because they see their corrupt leaders amassing so much wealth, while they are really, the rank and file right now is suffering greatly. And none of the aims of the revolution has been realized. So the military is also very vulnerable. And you know that they created parallel institutions. So we have the regular army, and then the militias, and then the Revolutionary Guards. And within their ranks, I mean, the Revolutionary Guards, over 70-something percent voted against the conservatives and pro-so-called reform camp in late 1990s. So it's very fragile. And that is why I think it's very similar to the to the Velvet Revolution. That is why also international help means a lot. I mean, having a backing in terms of knowing that the international community is behind you is very important.
Islam today is in a real crisis, is it not?
Yes.
And one of the reasons why it's in this real crisis is because of fundamentalism.
Yes.
Now, those who are not fundamentalists are somewhat concerned about speaking up, because if they speak up, they decapitate them, or they destroy them, or they put them in jail, or whatever. So the problem is, how are they ever going to get out of this turmoil that they are now in? And there are several other countries, as you know, in the Middle East, who are equally as destructive to the other so-called democratic people. So how in the world are they ever going to evolve
into something
into a democratic country that some would like to see it become? How are they going to do this? I don't understand how.
Well, Iran at the beginning of the revolution, as you mentioned, many of the grand ayatollahs who were, higher ranked than Ayatollah Khomeini, like Ayatollah Shariat Madari, Ayatollah Khairi, Aqomi, all of them were very much against linking of the state and religion, especially in Shia religion. In Shia, you do not rule this world. You know, this kingdom is not the place to rule. So what they were saying was that Khomeini is destroying Islam. And many of them, as you mentioned, were silenced or put into jail. But now in Iran, there is a group of very powerful clerics who since mid-80s have been questioning both the basic tenets of Orthodox interpretation of Islam as well as the combination of religion and state. And some of them were silenced, but they are gaining more and more momentum. Even people like Ayatollah Taheri in Isfahan, who was one of the founders of the Islamic Revolution at the beginning, after President, I think it was after President Bush's Axis of Evil talk, or right before it, he denounced the Islamic Revolution, and he said, "I'm ashamed of, you know, what has been done in the name of the Islamic Revolution." These people are concerned, and many of their followers now are understanding it. Just today in the New York Times, they were talking about the Grand Ayatollah Sistani meeting with the Barzani and the U.S. envoys, and these are the camp who want to separate religion from the state. So this clan is gaining momentum, and I think that crucial to its success is an understanding in the West, and especially now that U.S. is taking such a central role, to the fact that in order to create genuine reform within Islam and save this religion, you need to separate it from the state. Many of our State Department people are not convinced. Our people who are right now writing the constitution of Iraq are not convinced of the fact that you're mentioning. Our problem is not just with the Muslims, but with those who are interpreting them for us.
Yeah, but you also have the Muslim fundamentalists in this country.
Yes, you do. And as long as they get into the White House and the State Department and take their pictures with the president, they'll be really powerful. You should write not just to the congressman, but to your president, sir. Because they are there and they're active.
Are there any more questions?
There was that gentleman for a long time.
They're using our words and our principles against our fundamentals.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a question over here, and this will probably have to be the last question. Thank you.
Hi, good night. Mentioned Saul Bellow. I love Saul Bellow. Can you tell us other Jewish writers you've read in Iran, and I never spoke about sex. How is sexually explicit? Can you get away with novels?
Well, not much.
The lead narrative isn't explicit at all.
Well, that is what people become so creative. Of course, the first victims and the foremost victims are Persian writers. Most of the best among both the more, especially the modern classics, like one of our best modern contemporary poets, Bulgha Farrokhzad, who was a very, very good poet and a very sensual poet. She was censored, Hidayat, but also aspects of Rumi, aspects of Nizami. 1001 Nights, it came out at the beginning of the revolution and it was completely suppressed, which, by the way, shows that this culture is not the puritanical culture these people make it out to be, because some of the most sensual writings comes out of these writers. With the quote-unquote foreign languages, it is more difficult for them to control it, because most of the time they don't know. And it's usually after a while when you teach it or you write about it that they discover, and then they start banning it. When I went back, I never succumbed to any form of censorship for my classes. I have taught Tom Jones. I played a trick teaching Denis Diderot's Jacques Fataliste, because that book is so sexually explicit. So what I did, I gave copies of it to the class, and then went to class and said, bring back the copies next time, because there are some explicit sexual pages in here which we don't want to read, and I knew that every single student made a copy. And we discussed it. We discussed Jacques Fataliste in detail in class. So these are the tricks we play, you know. You mentioned Jewish writers. For me, it's so difficult to differentiate between writers, so I won't remember all of them. Bellow was a favorite with my class, especially, and they forced me actually to go and see him in 1996. friend, Hillel Fratkin, who knew him well, told me, do you want to see him? And I said, no, I mean, you know, I feel really bad just going to see someone you like because take their time for nothing. But when I went back home and told my kids, they got really mad. And they said, you go and see him. You know, and they gave poetry and they did a whole series of poems and paintings in relationship to Dean's December. So I went and saw him on the last day of January 1996. And we talked about all of these issues. It was really amazing. I'll never forget that. Philip Roth is known. Primo Levi, of course, is well known. There are so many. I mean, there's so many great Jewish writers. It's very difficult for me to think about. These are the three that come to my mind right now.
Tell me, when they get real mad, what do they do?
The students of the government. Listen, when they get really mad about not
about the political situation.
Well, they demonstrate, they protest, they have sit-ins, most of them are taken to jail. And it's ongoing. The student movement in Iran is very, very active.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is good.